This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. But the provision of health services is a critical and significant mission within each branch of the U.S. military. The U.S. Department of Navy's Bureau of Medicine and Surgery has a long and cherished tradition of serving and safeguarding the health of its service members and their families. In fact, the foundation of Navy medicine is force health protection, and that is ensuring the availability of a medically ready, healthy, and fit force. It is what it does. It's why it exists. Whether at sea or on the battlefield or at home, Navy medicine also plays a central role in the most effective joint casualty care and management system in military history, a system that has saved thousands of lives that otherwise would have been lost on the battlefield. What are Navy medicine's strategic priorities? What is force health protection? How is the continuum of care for military personnel being enhanced and strengthened? And how is medical research and development helping Navy medicine? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Vice Admiral Matthew Nathan, Surgeon General of the U.S. Navy. So, Admiral Nathan, thank you for joining us today. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here with both you and Gio.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Gio Patterson. Gio, welcome, as always.
Thank you.
So, Admiral, many are familiar with the U.S. Navy, but may not be as familiar with the U.S. Navy Bureau of Medicine and Surgery, also known as Navy Medicine. Would you share some of the history with us, and when was it established, and how does it support DOD's overall mission?
Well, Navy medicine formally came into line in the 1840s as the Bureau of Medicine and Surgery. We were designed at first to basically coordinate the activities of healthcare at sea, and throughout the centuries have migrated to be in care of the sailors, the Marines, their families, those who have retired and left a legacy for us to follow. And now we are very much diversified into significant research areas. But I like to tell people, our medical service is really responsible for providing care above the ocean in aviation, on the ocean in our surface Navy, below the ocean in our submarine force, and then on land as we support the Marines and the special operators such as SEAL groups and EOD groups. So we have a pretty wide portfolio that's developed throughout the years. And our job is really one of two missions. And it's one to be ready. And when people ask me what business I'm in, I like to tell them I'm in the readiness business. My job is to be ready for the next improvised explosive device that goes off in Afghanistan. My job is to be ready for the next mom who's gone into labor and needs her delivery at the threshold of one of our hospitals. I consider both to be paramount in readiness. And so there's an expectation on the Navy Medical Department, both from my bosses, the Chief of Naval Operations and the Commandant of the Marine Corps, to be there when they need us and to absolutely bring the best we have.
Admiral, with such a broad and critical mission, would you give us a sense of the scale of operation for Navy medicine? How is your office organized? What's the size of your staff? And perhaps give us a sense of the geographical disbursement of Navy medicine?
Sure. So we have a motto, Michael, in Navy medicine, which says world-class care anytime, anywhere. And because we are a maritime-centric force and we support a maritime-centric force, the Navy and Marine Corps, we basically call ourselves the away team. Our job is to be away from home, unlike perhaps the Army and the Air Force, which are more garrison-based services, and then when needed, deploy en masse to a foreign shore or to an area of conflict. The Navy's job is to be out and about most of the time, patrolling the waterways and the littoral areas, and to be engaged in trying to put out small fires before they become big ones, be it somewhere in the Persian Gulf or the South China Sea or the Atlantic or the Pacific. So Navy medicine must be agile to be with them. So if somebody said to me, where do you like to sort of stay in one place? Our answer is we don't like to stay in one place. We like to have bases from which we work with, but our job is to be out and about and be very responsive for any need that may come up. That said, we're organized with regions at home. We have the Navy Medicine East region headquartered out of Portsmouth, Virginia, and our tertiary care facility there. Navy Medicine West region out of San Diego, Navy Medical Center San Diego, and the National Capital Authority region out of the Bethesda area. And those are our three regions that support and headquarter all of our military treatment facilities, which include tertiary hospitals, family practice teaching hospitals, and smaller hospitals scattered throughout the world. And then we are task organized through our support to the warfighter as we provide Navy medicine, what we call surgeons, to the various fleets. So the Fleet Forces Command and the Pacific Command have surgeons that represent their medical needs to them. And we have surgeons for all our numbered fleets, the 4th Fleet, the 5th Fleet, the 6th Fleet, the 7th Fleet. I had a job once as the 7th Fleet surgeon. We have a public health system, which is headquartered in Virginia, and that's responsible in large part for the preventive medicine efforts that go on to maintain a warfighting capability. And it varies from protection for insect and infectious disease vectors to keep troops from becoming ill or injured, all the way to public safety, looking at vehicle mishaps, looking at any sort of foodborne type issues. And then we have our research units.
Admiral, now that you've given us a view of the global operation, maybe you could tell us more about your specific responsibilities as a U.S. Navy Surgeon General and the Chief of the Navy BUMED. What are your specific responsibilities and duties?
Well, my job is to be responsible to the Chief of Naval Operations and the Commandant of the Marine Corps. Informally, I would say that my job is to make sure that we have the best medical team available to both prepare the warfighter in the event they need to go into harm's way, to protect the warfighter in the event that they have something occur while in harm's way or while in deployment, and then to maintain a confidence in the Navy and Marine Corps that their families will be taken care of. I think both Michael and Jill, you would agree that it's very hard for you to keep your mind on the job if you were here or anywhere else, if you have a loved one who is suffering or who is ill and you can't be there. You'd be very preoccupied by that. So we do everything we can to instill confidence in our troops and our crews that while they're away from home, or even at home, that we're going to be there for their families, we're going to be there to take care of them, and they can concentrate on other things because the medical care is not going to be an issue. Formally, my task is really to provide the manning and the training and the equipping of medical forces that lie resident in the United States Navy.
So, Admiral, regarding your role and responsibility, what are your top challenges? What are the three top challenges you face, and have you sought to address them?
Well, so, Michael, it's a great question because we're coming now off of over 10 years of war. This is unheralded. We've not seen this in our country's history. It has done a couple things. One, it's led us to some tremendous innovations in combat casualty care and in deployment medicine. But it's also been very taxing. And it's created a cadre of servicemen and servicewomen who have challenges that we hadn't seen or hadn't seen to this degree in such protracted warfare. There's an expectation, and I believe it's quite legitimate, on me and on my Navy Medical Department that we be a marquee organization when it comes to peacetime health care. So my other challenge is I have to maintain a vibrant readiness force that can deploy at a moment's notice and that can be ready to operate in what could be an unfamiliar environment. So my challenge is to maintain the quality care that somebody seeks in one of our medical facilities and at the same time be able to deploy and maintain first-class combat support care in a hostile or even simply an austere environment. Like everything else in healthcare, and we're not immune from the American healthcare system, it's expensive. And the cost of healthcare to the Department of Defense, among all the services, has been escalating at unprecedented rates. And so the Secretary of Defense and the secretaries of the services, as well as the executive branch, is depending on us to look for new and innovative ways to reduce the cost of healthcare in the Department of Defense, just as the leadership of this nation is looking for some sort of game changer to try to bring down the cost to the average American for health care and to increase access. We're looking for innovative ways that we can give some resources back to the Department of Defense and without sacrificing any of the quality that people have become accustomed to in military health care.
Admiral, along with the challenges you've encountered leading Navy medicine, can you also discuss your unanticipated or unexpected surprises? To that end, what has surprised you the most since taking over this role?
Well, Gio, it's a great question because if you'd asked me 3 years ago, would I be looking at the normal budget challenges that occur in healthcare, I'd say absolutely. If you'd say, are we going to season that gingerly with sequestration and continuing resolutions and try to figure out what won't be involved in those, we hadn't really expected that. When I used to speak to civic organizations over a year ago and they'd say, what do you think the impacts of sequestration are going to be? I, like many leaders, would say throughout the government, would say, well, hopefully it won't come to that. We think that maybe sequestration won't be a big issue. But it has come to that. And I will say that my leaders have been very supportive in trying to minimize the effects of sequestration when it comes to the provision of medical care and the ability to protect our fighting forces. We're moving resources around and we're shifting assets so that nobody who's deployed or nobody who's in an austere environment will feel any effect of this. But nonetheless, depending on how long and how significant the budget situation goes on, my job is to work through that. My job is to give a coherent plan to my boss on how I'm going to meet their mission and yet be faithful to some of the budget challenges that we have.
What are Navy medicine's strategic priorities? We will ask Vice Admiral Matthew Nathan, Surgeon General of the U.S. Navy, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Is there a recipe for successful cross-agency collaborations that are enduring? Or is each initiative so dependent on context and personality that there's no way to offer general principles of success? Well, an IBM Center report by Dr. Jane Fountain, Implementing Cross-Agency Collaborations, a Guide for Federal Managers, offers advice on successful cross-agency relationships. Fountain says there's, in fact, a recipe for success, but it depends on the number of factors. Go to businessofgovernment.org, download Jane Fountain's report, and find out. That's businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Vice Admiral Matthew Nathan, Surgeon General of the U.S. Navy. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Gio Patterson. So, Admiral Nathan, you had mentioned that Navy medicine must perform from the sea to the land in the toughest environments and across the spectrum of military mission. But to do it successfully requires a strategic vision and for you to chart a course for your folks, for the folks that support you. Would you outline that strategic vision and briefly describe your core priorities?
Sure. So I think that we've tried to be as concise and succinct as possible with our strategic vision. And it starts with readiness. Readiness is job one for us. As we've talked about before, that's the business I'm in. I'm expected to be able to answer the bell anywhere, anytime around the world. I like to think of us as part of the Navy Marine Corps team as sort of the world's 911. If there's a foreign land or an environment somewhere that gets into trouble, either through a man-made disaster or through a natural disaster, we'd like to believe that we can be on scene very soon. Second is value. And value comes back to the point where we have to constantly be analyzing what we do, how we do it, and how much bang for the buck. I tell my people it's really sort of a fraction described as quality times capability divided by cost. And so what does that mean? That means if I'm doing a certain procedure in a certain hospital, and I do it fairly rarely, but it costs me a pretty penny to do it, as much as I might like being able to have that procedure in my portfolio, does it make more sense to export that to a local hospital nearby? Or do I need that procedure to maintain a skills preservation for my doctors when they go overseas? I have to constantly be analyzing that. Because in the past, I would tell you, when cost was not on the forefront of the military medical leaders, we simply put safety and we put readiness as job one, and we didn't worry too much about the cost. Now we have to evaluate everything we do and look at it from the standpoint of, is it worth it? And whatever we do, we're going to do first class and safely. But let's make sure our portfolio includes only those things that really bring value to our system. And then the third is joint. I need my people to start thinking more and more joint. I'm a believer because of my experience at Walter Reed Bethesda, where we sort of built this, I call it a Reese's peanut butter cup, where one hospital brought the chocolate, the other brought the peanut butter. We put them together, and we have this synergy of best practices that occurred. I've seen the utility and the value of doing things jointly. In addition, it doesn't make good business sense for the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy to have three different medical systems that use three different types of, for instance, IMIT technologies, pharmaceutical systems, education training systems. Why not figure out a way to standardize those, create best practices, share those among the services, reduce redundancies, and create more jointness? Not going as far as the purple suit that some people talk about, which is everybody will just simply wear one uniform and we'll sort of homogenize the Army and the Navy and the Air Force. I think it's critically important we preserve the traditions and the cultural ethos of the services. But we can certainly do that while creating much more alignment and much more joint care.
So, Admiral, what are the guiding principles that frame your command philosophy as?
I tell my people I believe in ship, shipmate, and self. And in the Navy, we say you've got to take care of the ship, because if you don't and you lose the ship, nothing else matters. You yourself are now lost and the mission is lost. Mm-hmm. Shipmate, we've got to look after each other. I think one of the reasons I've stayed in the military for a career, and I trained in an academic residency, a non-military residency, so I've maintained great friendships with people I trained with, you know, over 30 years ago. But one of the things I've enjoyed is the covenant relationship that we have with our people. The fact that our job is to monitor their health, monitor how their welfare, and to, and some would say intrude when necessary, to help people through situations and take care of them when they're not doing well. And that's a shipmate taking care of a shipmate. And then self, taking care of yourself, raising your hand when you need help. Letting people know if you're not doing well. Letting people know if you need help either because of a personal issue or a professional one. You can't handle what you've been asked to do, and raise your hand and do it. So I've tried very hard to create a non-stigma, guilt-free environment where somebody can raise their hand and say, I need help, where somebody can be constantly vigilant about the people they work around and notice subtle or dramatic changes, and recognize that they have to take care of the mission around them, in this case the ship, or that might be the Marine unit you're assigned to, or it might be the Naval hospital you work for.
Admiral, Navy medicine is in the business of force health protection. Would you elaborate on the key components of force health protection and how it relates to force readiness, ensuring your service stays sharp, lean, and ready anytime, anywhere?
It's a great question, Gio. If I were to ask you during, say, in the African conflicts in the desert in North Africa and in parts of the war in the Pacific, in some of the jungles, what a commander feared the most that would impact their mission the most and it would possibly cause them to lose capability to fight, it would not be, the enemy would be high on the list, but it wouldn't be top. The top thing would be illness, dysentery, malaria, infectious disease, what's called jungle rot by allowing moisture and fungus and not being able to clean the feet and that sort of thing. Those would bring a unit to its knees much faster than the enemy could. And so our job is to make sure that when somebody goes into an austere environment, a hostile environment, all the way from a humanitarian disaster, which may be an earthquake or a tsunami or a hurricane, to kinetic war, that they go in as protected as possible so that they can be at their peak, they can be on their game, they can concentrate all their facilities on the job at hand. They will have the best equipment to protect the eyes, to protect the ears. They will have the best immunizations to ward off infections. They will have the best ready medical supplies near them to take care of small injuries before they worsen. And they'll have the best major resuscitative equipment to take care of catastrophic injuries and catastrophic illness. One of the great changes that has occurred in combat casualty care is that over the years, if you looked at World War I, II, Korea, Vietnam, if you were catastrophically injured in field, the time you were injured to the time you eventually made it back to the States to a tertiary care facility like a Bethesda or a veterans hospital was 45 to 60 days. So we provided care in theater, and we believed in sort of stabilizing in theater before getting back to the States. So 45 to 60 days. In this war, from the average time that you are catastrophically injured until the time you arrive at the bed here at Bethesda is 3 to 5 days. And that has mostly been facilitated by the on-scene resuscitative care and by the great Air Force medical evacuation system, which has these flying ICUs, which can fly the most significantly injured and ill people in the world safely across the ocean.
Admiral, we heard you say one of the greatest honors of being in the Navy medicine is the mission of supporting the Marines on the battlefield. The continuum of care for combat wounded is unprecedented, as you just shared with us, the survivability rate of nearly 97%. Would you elaborate on your efforts to enhance and strengthen the continuum of care for military personnel from point of accession through active service to rehabilitation and transition?
The continuum of care really encompasses what I guess could be described ironically as sort of a ballet or an orchestra of care that is facilitated across the joint spectrum. And so you're injured. Well, here's what's changed. So the corpsman or the medic who's there on scene now has updated tourniquet therapy. They have quick clotting substances they can give. They have body armor, which protects. We have a medical evacuation system, which is highly responsive. And we're very good at getting people within that first 15 minutes to 75 minutes of what we call the platinum slash golden hour of care to a resuscitative station, to where they can be resuscitated, reverse the shock. And that's a ballet of joint forces. For instance, if you look at Bastion in Afghanistan, that is some Air Force, Navy, Army, and British working that facility. And then we have some joint forces in Bagram and in Kandahar and other places. Then once you're stabilized, we get you out of there. The idea is not to hold on to you there. It's not to do definitive care. It's to package you up, get you stabilized, get you to Landstuhl Regional Army Medical Center, where further stabilization is done a little more sophisticated, but again, not definitive therapy, just enough to get you stable for the flight back home. Then the Air Force picks you up and flies you and gets you back to San Diego or Brooke Army Hospital or Walter Reed Bethesda. And that's where really I think the military excels from that point, from before that point, and now we get you to a place where you need rehabilitation, prosthetic rehabilitation, and also emotional rehabilitation.
Well, I'd like to go back, Admiral. You had mentioned earlier that the survivability rate, I think we said upwards of 97%, and it takes folks 3 to 5 days to get to the States for care. But the greater the rates is sort of a double-edged sword because you've got it's a positive, but you're also dealing with folks, as you said, are severely injuries, amputations, and what have you. These create new challenges, and you touched on them, but I'd like for you to elaborate a little bit. What are you doing to address these challenges, and what programs are available?
There's been a tremendous impetus to try to address what I call a sort of a good news problem. The good news meaning that we've had people return from the war. We've had a few soldiers and Marines who returned from the war who have been quadruple amputees. Now, you know, some people have said to me, gosh, you've lost all your limbs. Is that worth it? And my answer is, these heroes, they engage with their families. There's new technologies occurring. You may have seen recently there was a double arm transplant at Hopkins. So every day we're learning something new about some of the physically devastating injuries with magnificent prosthetics and with regenerative medicine and with transplant medicine that I think is going to give people their lives back. But that is something that we hadn't seen before because those kinds of injuries wouldn't have survived. And then you get into the traumatic brain injury, which can vary from mild, from just concussion, to the major, to a open head injury, to the post-traumatic stress. And how do we approach that? We're looking very hard at innovative sciences. We've found now that complementary alternative medicine, which when I was in medical school, if somebody had said, we have an acupuncturist here and they want to put some needles in for your headache, I'd say, get out of here. And now when I get a bad headache, where's that needle? We're finding that these kinds of things, biofeedback mechanisms, hypnosis, I'm not saying that's where the center of gravity of the care is, but I'm just saying that we've opened the aperture to any and all possibilities now to find a way ahead for some of these folks. The number one thing we found, Michael, that has made a difference in our moderate to severe TBI patients and our post-traumatic stress patients is a comprehensive multidisciplinary approach to them, bringing in at the same time not only engaging them but engaging their families as well. Here's what I like to say. I'll illustrate it by example. When I was the commander at Walter Reed, Bethesda, I was seeing the new casualties that came in, and we had a young Marine who came in who had lost his leg pretty high up in the leg and part of his hand. His family had arrived because one of the things we do now in combat casualty care is we bring the families in right away. We fly them in the next day. Now, that's good in that they can be there right away, and it's bad because they haven't really had time to adjust to what they've heard. So I walk in, and this Marine was fine. He'd lost a leg, and he was newly arrived, and he was excited about going to the operating room and getting the touch-up changes and getting into the prosthetic rehabilitation. And he had his young son with him, who looked like 5 or 6, and he had his wife with him. And his son was saying in the course of the conversation, who was a little bit bewildered by all this, I guess they had planned to go to Disney World at the end of the tour when he was coming home. But he came home early, of course, and now with an amputation. And his son said, Daddy, are we still going to go to Disney World? And so the Marine sort of saddened up and teared up a little bit, and his wife teared up a little bit because they didn't know what to say to the little boy looking at this missing leg. And I said, well, when are you going? And he said, well, we're supposed to go when I got back. That was about 8 months from now. And I said, yeah. I said, you're going to go. I said, 8 or 9 months? I said, we'll have you up. We'll have you walking. I said, not only will your dad take you to Disney World, he'll take you on every ride. And the little boy brightened up, the wife brightened up, and the Marine sort of beckoned me to him, and I bent down. I said, you know, I'm not making this up. He said, it's not that, sir. He said, I didn't like those rides to begin with. So my point is that he will engage with his family again. And yes, he'll have some, and I'm not trivializing his injury, but he will be able to play catch with his son and laugh with his son and roll around on the floor with his son and carry his son on his back in a piggyback ride. If he had moderate to severe traumatic brain injury or post-traumatic stress, I couldn't make that promise to him because that can take the whole family with it. The whole family can be consumed by the altered affect and personality and challenges of that. And so we really are looking at ways to engage the family and the wounded warrior at the same time or the injured person at the same time through a lot of modalities, using more sophisticated sensors, more sophisticated therapies, using much more alternative therapies.
How is the continuum of care for military personnel being enhanced and strengthened? We will ask Vice Admiral Matthew Nathan, Surgeon General of the U.S. Navy, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Pundits warn about the fiscal cliff, but federal agencies nearly every year hold up the budgetary sky while walking on the edge of a cliff. It's called the world of continuing resolutions and potential government shutdowns. The IBM Center report, The Cost of Budgetary Uncertainty, Analyzing the Impact of Late Appropriations by Dr. Phil Joyce, examines the impact of late budgets on the efficiency and effectiveness of government operations. To find out more about the cost of budgetary uncertainty, go to businessofgovernment.org. That's businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Vice Admiral Matthew Nathan, Surgeon General of the U.S. Navy. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Geo Patterson. So, Admiral Nathan, Navy medicine would not accomplish much of its mission without a robust research and development portfolio. Would you tell us a little bit about the research priorities for Navy medicine, and how has it impacted the delivery of care?
Some of the most significant advances, I think, in peacetime care have come through the exploration and the research of issues, illnesses, and injuries that affect us in a wartime environment. We may be in the near term looking at a vaccine for malaria. Now, malaria is the number one infectious disease killer in the world. We don't think of that much in the United States, but it ravages other populations. Dengue fever, dysentery, certain encephalitises that are carried, West Nile and others that are carried through mosquitoes and through flies. The origins of our research start in trying to protect our troops. But this bleeds over into eventually protecting our peacetime. The model for trauma care in this country was based on our experiences in Vietnam. That's where we learned about the Golden Hour, and we learned about having an actual trauma support center, such as shock trauma at Baltimore and other places. We're learning things now in this conflict through research development of trauma care, be it clotting agents, be it artificial blood, body armor, tourniquet therapy, that will be on an ambulance today in a motor vehicle, a critical motor vehicle accident somewhere in the Beltway. So we're going to change lives just as a result of that research. Most of our research is done, of course, to try to figure out how to be better force protectors and or care responders for our troops and our crews, be they submarines and the environment of working in a submarine and the atmospheric and the pressure. When people go scuba diving for recreation in the Caribbean, the reason they know how far they can go and how much air they can breathe is because the U.S. Navy developed those tables years ago in trying to protect its divers from decompression illness. So these things carry over. I think we get a twofer in our research, especially our research overseas, where we have places where we embed in overseas countries. First of all, the countries may be an environment where these illnesses are prevalent, so we can really study them. Secondly, the engagement we get, the cooperation we get among the host nations is nothing but good. The partnerships that we have, sometimes in environments where they can be a little bit dicey and where the politics may be somewhat fragile, our relationships and the fact that our only agenda for being there is research and the advancement of science and the advancement of betterment of all people, including the host nation, really carries the day in many of these cases. And so I'm very proud of that part of it. But we have researchers just down the road at Walter Reed Bethesda who are looking at new and innovative ways to treat cancer, all the way to somebody who's looking at a mosquito in Lima, Peru, and determining how to create some sort of genetic variation so that the mosquito can no longer carry a certain disease. Yes, that's going to make a difference in the lives of our troops, but there's also going to be a young child born in the near future somewhere in the world who's not going to suffer something because of the Navy research that's going on.
I hadn't realized the R&D portfolio was another element of soft power. It's interesting. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think it's because and medical has always been a medical itself, military medicine itself has always been a great soft power, tool in the toolkit, because the agenda is health and wellness. And so often we can be a great icebreaker.
Admiral, Navy medicine has a significant track record of engaging in humanitarian missions and responding to disasters. Could you elaborate for a moment on Navy medicine's involvement in some of the most recent relief efforts? And to what extent does such engagement represent an extension of U.S. soft power?
When you look at Indonesia and how at one time that country had a pretty strong anti-American sentiment, they suffer a calamitous tsunami. And we send the Lincoln Battle Group there. We send the hospital ship Mercy there. They see American troops helping rebuild infrastructure, schools. They see American troops taking care of children, looking at disease and injury. And the sentiment changes because of goodwill. The Navy's motto, it's not Navy medicine's motto, it's the Navy motto. It's a global force for good. I think that appeals to young people. I think a young person today, the generation today, watching the ads on the TV or looking in a magazine or whatever, they're patriotic and they want to be part of the national defense and they're willing to be part of the national security. And they're certainly willing and able to step up and fight when they have to in a hostile environment to protect, you know, our nation's interests. But they also like being part of something that leaves the world a little better place. And they like being part of something where we have ships that can bring war power when necessary, and we have ships that can bring tremendous compassion and healing when necessary. So I think that's one of our selling points. Yes, the research allows us to retain some very, very world-class scientists in the Navy because we have some very, very world-class and unique research environments.
Admiral, with the rising health care costs, the increased number of beneficiaries, and maintaining this long-term care responsibility for our medically retired warriors, your focus on the value is key in your decision-making. To that end, would you tell us more about your efforts to realize sustained value and elaborate on your concept of value being quality multiplied by capability, all divided by cost?
Great, great question. And I think this is what keeps CEOs of any major healthcare system awake right now. Whether you were talking to the CEO at Hopkins or Geisinger or Cleveland Clinic, how are we going to figure out how to improve access, improve health, and reduce costs? From the president on down, everybody's looking hard at how we can change the game, not only in military medicine, but in our private sectors and academic sectors as well. I believe that the answer lies in truly harnessing technology and creating more virtual care. Virtual medicine allows more health. What do I mean by that? We've become a nation that sort of has rewarded health care in the way we pay our system more than rewarding health. Most of our providers in this country get rewarded or paid by doing sort of more to a patient than less. It's not bad. It's just a system that's not predicated on really keeping the patient healthy. I like to tease and say we should be more like the 15th century Chinese who used to pay their physicians while they were healthy. And when they got sick, they stopped paying their doctors. So their doctors were vitally concerned with making sure they didn't get ill. We're trying to harness that in our organization and trying to look at new and innovative ways to reward and recognize our providers based on how healthy they keep their population. And then the risk is really on the healthcare organization to keep those people healthy, because if they don't, they're going to lose more money than make it. So how can you do this? You need a few ingredients. One is you need an electronic medical record. We have that in the military. Two, you need a population that's insured and can come to your hospitals and get your healthcare when they need it. We have that in the military. Three, you need providers that are rewarded for health and not necessarily that interested in patients becoming ill. We have that in our system. And I think all physicians, all providers want their patients to be as healthy as possible, but we're really trying to put the emphasis on health instead of health care. We have less people in our country now than we ever have who are able to join the military. We have many who are willing, but less who are able simply because of health issues at young ages or fitness issues at young ages. A variety of other reasons as well. But the bottom line is, strategically and medically, I need to alter people's healthcare choices.
So, Admiral, the patient-centered medical home represents a shift toward a more holistic approach to healthcare delivery. And with virtual healthcare, it's a nice segue. Would you tell us more about your efforts to implement this kind of healthcare model in Navy medicine? I believe it's called the Medical Home Port Program. How is it revitalizing your primary care system?
This is basically an environment where you can increase the continuity of care of a patient. What do I mean by medical home? You feel like you're at home when you're there. They know you. If you were to talk to many of our beneficiaries in military medicine over the last several years, many of them would say, once I get in to see you, the care is great, but sometimes it's hard to get in to see you. And secondly, sometimes when I get in to see you, there's a different person there, and I have to start all over from square one. And so I really would love to have my good old doc or that nurse who knows me since, you know, for 4 years. And we do, too. We want that as well. Now, we're a rotational organization. Our people move and rotate. And so how do we combat that? So we've created Patient-Centered Medical Home, which is a pod of providers centered around a physician, a nurse practitioner, a physician's assistant, perhaps an advanced duty corpsman, all of them who know you. Mm-hmm. One of them is available to you where this is working. We don't have it everywhere yet, but it's growing. But where it's working, you can reach one of them at all times. In addition, you communicate to them majority of the time through either a web-based, secure web-based system or through email or through an iPhone or whatever. You don't have to come in for everything. Harnessing the power of digital and telemedicine is critical. And I would add pivotal to the United States Navy because I need that more than any place else because I have so many medical facilities displaced all over the world. They're called ships. If I have a doctor on a ship that's in the South China Sea and he has a patient who comes to him and he thinks they're having a heart attack or a stroke or maybe some debilitating abdominal problem, I want to equip him with things where he can transmit the information back to a place like Bethesda or Portsmouth. And I can have a myriad of cardiologists, surgeons, OBGYN doctors, neurologists standing around looking at the images he's transmitting, looking at the electrocardiogram he's transmitting, even looking at pictures he's transmitting of the patient and calling in information. And that way I can provide the firepower, the medical firepower of a tertiary care hospital to a small little ship that's out in the middle of the ocean. So already we're leveraging what I'd call virtual medicine, telemedicine. And I believe that, A, that's good for people in austere environments, and B, that's going to be the game changer for cost.
Making headways on the cost or access to healthcare requires continued leveraging of information management or IT at all levels of care. Would you tell us more about how you are enhancing your use of healthcare informatics and also sharing electronic health data across DOD and VA?
Thanks, Gio. It's a great and very timely question. As we talked a little bit about before, we've had some separate stovepipes in the way each service runs its IMIT departments, both those that communicate the electronic medical record and those that also use digital systems for patient care, pharmacy dispensation systems, those kinds of things. We're going to create a defense health agency that will allow us to share all those services in one place. I've told people before, I don't really want to be in the IMIT business and have to own that in Navy medicine. I need it as a service, and I need it to be expeditious and available, but I'm happy to outsource that if I can have it reliably provided to me. The Army and the Air Force feel the same way. So we're looking at how we can create one sort of system that integrates all of our care systems together to make one large system. And then once we do that, the next question you may want to ask is, how do you put that together with the next continuum in military care, which is the VA, the VA system? So we're working very hard with the VA to try to find an integrated electronic health record, an IEHR is what it's called. So we're working very hard with that because right now one of the laments of some of our service members is when I go to the VA, they're compassionate, they're great, the care is great, but they can't see what happened to me when I was on active duty. Mm-hmm. I have to bring my paper record with me, and they have to flip through a paper record. Well, I have to tell you, the paper records should be like the dinosaur. It should become extinct at some point. And the fact that anybody has to carry around a paper record, I think, is an indictment on the system. And, of course, that's still commonly the way care is given in this country. But I think the VA and the Department of Defense are looking very closely at integrating a health record electronically. Again, we're looking at anything that can be done to capture what I believe is the desire of the upcoming generations to be connected more electronically. I'm generalizing a little bit here, but my 80-year-old patient wants to drive 40 miles and park in the parking deck and go to the pharmacy and actually see the pharmacist hand them the pills. My 20-year-old patient would just as soon have it delivered on their door because they hit something on their iPhone. So we're developing an iPhone app that allows you to refill your pharmacy. So here you are. You're somewhere. You're stuck in traffic. You know your medicine's running out. You go on the iPhone app. It's secure. And you all of a sudden punch in something. You get your pharmacy prescription number. It asks you, refill? Yes. Where do you want it sent? Home? Yes. You're done. And that saves money. It removes the middleman. It makes it expeditious. And it's one less car that has to be in the parking lot.
What does the future hold for Navy medicine? We will ask Vice Admiral Matthew Nathan, Surgeon General of the U.S. Navy, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How do leaders direct ambitious change and achieve significant goals? What strategies do they use to overcome opposition and win allies? And how do specific organizational and political contexts affect strategies and outcomes? These are important age-old questions. To help answer them, the IBM Center has released Forging Governmental Change by Professor Harry Lambright. Lambright has identified two premier government leaders, Dr. Robert Gates of DOD and Dr. Francis Collins of NIH, who have led transformations within their own organizations. By all accounts, both men have been effective leaders of change. This report continues the IBM Center's long interest in leadership and transformation. So go to businessofgovernment.org and download Forging Governmental Change, Lessons from Transformations Led by Robert Gates and Francis Collins. That's businessofgovernment.org. There you can download all Center reports and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Vice Admiral Matthew Nathan, Surgeon General of the U.S. Navy. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Geo Patterson. I talk to many of my guests about the use of collaboration and partnerships among agencies, branches of the government, and with the private sector to achieve mission results. How are you at Navy Medicine using partnerships and collaborating, and I think this dovetails with jointness as well, to improve operations and program outcomes?
Clearly, the more you can learn from, share, partner, team up, become joint with other marquee organizations, the more you're going to accelerate the ability to provide care in a professional and in a cost-effective way. We want to leverage this country's great patriotic desires. We want to leverage the academic institutions, the private sector, who I have to say, everywhere I go, be it any organization I talk to in the private or academic sector, all they want to know is how they can help. They really do. And many of these in the past have sort of been parochial and very protective of their research or protective of their grant money or protective of what they're doing because they don't want somebody to steal their thunder. But when I come in, they say, you know what? For you, we want to be totally transparent. If there's something we're doing which you think can help, please let us know. They also enjoy the give and the take from the military because we have so many experiences that we can bring to them. It'll probably be military-based providers along with private sector, but it'll probably be a center of gravity of military-based providers who will discover the vaccine for malaria. Mm-hmm. And so, again, I think that this kind of rising tide lifts everybody's boats. We're very interested in partnering in what we were talking about before in traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress. There are some places who have been doing this in the private and academic sectors for years and years and years and are just outstanding at it. What they haven't had is exposure to the kinds of injuries that we're seeing in the military. So they're desperately interested in getting engaged with us. What kind of injuries do they see? Motor vehicle accidents, gunshot wounds, somebody falling off a ladder. They have not seen people standing 20 feet away from a massive explosion and receiving that kind of concussive blast. So that's a whole new kind of head injury that we don't get in America. We don't get in the world because people are succumbing to motor vehicle injuries and gunshots and hitting their head at a fraternity party, but they're not being blown up. And so these organizations are vitally interested in seeing our results, our scans, partnering with us, sending some of their people to work in our hospitals, and inviting some of our people to work in their hospitals so that we can do this. I'm encouraged by the collaboration that's going on. I'm not yet satisfied by it. It's still, in my opinion, still in its infancy, and it can be much more robust. But we're getting there. The flywheel's starting to turn. And I think that those kinds of cooperative agreements, along with the jointness where the Army and the Air Force and the Navy all throw in together with the VA, federal medicine, I think is becoming more joint, more altruistic. And the cooperation we're seeing with the private sector is significantly better than it's ever been, but it's not where we need it yet.
Admiral, I'd like to transition now to the future. What are some of the major opportunities and challenges that Navy medicine will encounter in the future, and how do you envision your office will need to evolve over the next couple of years to meet those challenges?
Thanks, Joe. It's a question that I and my team wrestle with every day, again, getting back to where do we think the puck is going to be so we can skate to it. There is more and more of an expectation because of our track record so far that Mr. and Mrs. America, who has a son or a daughter, or a brother or a sister, or a husband or a wife who is somewhere in the armed services, there is more and more of an expectation that if something happens to them any place in the world, they'll get the kind of care that if they had had that same thing happen on the steps at Hopkins or the steps at Bethesda. And so I am vitally interested in figuring out how to translocate care in using virtual care, using technology, using telemedicine, to bring that expectation true. I think that the other great challenge for us is the socioeconomic challenge of the cost of healthcare, and how do we get that under control and at the same time not sacrifice some of the gains we've made. And so what I've told my people for the future is we need to do a complete sort of soup-to-nuts look at all our infrastructure in Navy medicine, because it's built on, and antiquated is too strong a word, but it's built on a premise, an existing premise, that lots of buildings and brick and mortar is good. And I'm not so sure it is anymore. And I think if you look at other marquee private sector healthcare systems, you'll see more of them and more of them going to really concentrating the gravitas on ambulatory care facilities and virtual medicine. And we need to at least be even with that, if not, I think, leave it beyond. And so I've asked my folks to take a hard look at what is tomorrow's sailor, what is tomorrow's Marine, what is their family going to need? And that's the other big issue, family care. World War I and II, most service members didn't have families. These days, most do. The family is a critical part of the care, not just for taking care of the family, but for making sure that the service member feels comfortable and can do their job. So we're looking at family programs. I'm often asked about, you have pediatricians and OBGYN doctors in the Navy or in the armed services. Do you really need them? I mean, would we lose a war if we didn't have military pediatricians? The answer, we probably wouldn't lose a war, but my military staff bring something to the game, an understanding of the military family, of the ethos, of the challenges of the military and deployment, as well as, when necessary, we're doing more and more humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. And I don't fault it, but I recognize the fact that I can't grab a civilian pediatrician who's in the middle of a practice and say, I need you to be in Haiti in 48 hours because the country's just destroyed itself through an earthquake. They'll say, I'll get there when I can, but it may be weeks, whereas my people can be there. When the Haitian earthquake went down, we had the hospital ship Comfort underway within 72 hours with a crew that went down there and performed miraculous resuscitative and crushing injury surgeries to sort of